Usually I have found a reason to say no within 90 seconds. So trying to say no as soon as possible.
What is that person that you're looking for? What characteristics do you look for in great management? So what tells you this is a great CEO, for example?
Wonderful companies, the fair price to start with. But once you find them, once you've bought them, probably just letting them run as long as everything goes well.
One of the things that I really love about the book is that it's not just theory. It's actually a very practical book.
Someone is focusing on growth and someone else, for example, on value, that they are clashing and don't agree and you are a fool and things like that.
Very interesting filters. If there would be one that you have to compromise on, which one would it be?
Based on that investable universe, obviously you are doing your own homework, you're doing your own due diligence. Hopefully your portfolio, your stock picks are even better than the ones within your investable universe.
One of the most we have at Amazon is we have Jeff Bezos and you don't. How do you think about that?
Welcome to Multi-Bagger Nuggets, where we talk about investing in stocks. Your host, Chris Hendricks, also known as From Growth to Value, invites you to join this podcast and the accompanying website, where you get much more content, both free and paid. Today, we have a special guest joining us, Peter Sleegers, better known as Compounding Quality. He has over 500,000 followers and just published a book called The Art of Quality Investing. Let's dive into this great conversation with a passionate investor, author, and teacher. Here's Multi-Bagger Nuggets, where you hear about tomorrow's winners today.
Hello, Peter. Welcome to Multi-Bagger Nuggets. For the people who don't know you, I will introduce you first. So on X, former Twitter, you have 365,000 followers. You have 230,000 people reading your newsletter, Compounding Quality, 150,000 people following you on LinkedIn. I probably forget a few things, but welcome to Multi-Bagger Nuggets. I'm really happy that you're here.
Thank you very much, Chris. I think the honor is likewise, and the honor is all mine, as a matter of fact, because it's funny that we are doing the podcast right now, because probably over the last few months, we've evolved to knowing each other via X or Twitter to becoming great friends. So it's really nice to have this conversation today.
Yeah, well, I know quite a lot of people in this business, and I think you probably know even more people than I do, but you're the only friend that I have in the business in the real sense of the word, like the five people that you care about the most. Let's talk about The Art of Quality Investing, because that's the book that you got out, and it's a mega success already, bestseller on Amazon. It's a great book. I have read it. People who don't know who it is, here it is. It's a fantastic book. It's The Art of Quality Investing. And the first thing I want to ask you about is about the word, the art of quality investing, which I find a very interesting choice of words. Can you talk about that aspect of the title?
Yeah, sure. So like you said, Chris, the book is called, or the name of the book is The Art of Quality Investing. And it's funny that you asked, because a few months ago, I attended an event and someone gave a presentation. And basically what he said is, well, he asked the audience, is investing a science? Is it an art or is it a craft? And most people, probably 50% of the room said, well, it's an art. 50% said it's a craft. And then the point the presenter wants to make is, well, it's all three of them. So it's a science, it's an art, and it's also a craft. Because you can indeed use rational frameworks to make investment decisions, look at your investment IDs and so on. But in the end, I still believe, and also luck beliefs, because credits to those who deserve well. I worked with Luck on this one, and Luck did 99% of the work. So he's an amazing guy, living in Belgium as well. But yeah, investing is really an art. So what you try to do with quality investing is really trying to pick up wonderful companies at a fair price. And combining all those different kind of aspects, well, you need to be experienced as an investor. You need to be creative. And that's why we really felt like The Art of Quality Investing is an excellent title for the book, because it shows or underlines what the book wants to stand for.
Yeah, I think it also reminds me of, I forgot who wrote it, but Investing the Lost Liberal Art, I think is the title. And that's also why I like the title as well, The Art of Quality Investing. There's a word that is both in the title and in your name, and that's quality. Let's talk about quality. What do you see as quality, and what is quality in stocks?
A very straightforward question, right? So name of the book, The Art of Quality Investing, name of the account I'm operating under, compounding quality. So what you try to do is obviously compounding. We all want to do that. Let the magic of compounding work for you. And then quality by investing in wonderful companies or quality stocks. And when you probably ask 10 different people what is quality investing, you will get 10 at least slightly different answers. Well, when you ask it to me, I would probably say quality investing is all about investing in the best companies in the world. And many listeners will know the quote of Warren Buffett. Well, you want to buy wonderful companies at a fair price instead of fair companies at a wonderful price. Right. When you go one step further and you look at the steps you can use to find these kind of companies, once again, credits to those who deserve. Based on Warren Buffett on the one hand and Terry Smith on the other hand, well, it's one, you try to buy wonderful companies. Then two, you want those wonderful companies to be led by excellent managers. And then three, well, it's the art to pick up those wonderful companies led by excellent managers at a fair valuation level. So that's at least to me what quality investing is all about.
Is the order correct in that sense that valuation is the last part that you look at?
For me, it is. So what you first try to do is indeed you try to find those wonderful companies and you are really strict in that. So for example, probably worldwide, there are something like 60,000 listed companies. When I look at the investable universe for me, for compounding quality, well, out of those 60,000, companies, probably right now 149 companies remain. So yeah, that's only a fraction of all listed companies. And then you didn't even look at valuation yet, and you didn't even look at skin in the game yet. So when you add the skin in the game part or the wonderful managers part, maybe only 50 companies remain. And then out of those 50 companies, well, there are plenty of businesses trading at very lofty valuation levels. And then you try to pick companies up that trade at least fair valuation levels. But when you have a business, for example, like Copart, and I'm not invested in Copart today because personally, I might be wrong, the valuation is too expensive. But I know, or at least I believe that Copart is a phenomenal business. And when valuation will come down one day, well, in that case, I would be really happy to own the company. So it's really attractive or really interesting to keep it on your watch list and be patient. And when crisis arrives or some short-term problems at Copart and the multiple declines, in that case, it might be really attractive to pick up the company.
Yeah. Well, actually, I agree. I am a shareholder of Copart, and that is because we picked it in Best Anchor Stocks. I invest every 2 weeks, and it's been quite a while since I added to my position in Copart because I think as well that at this valuation, it's expensive and a lot is already baked in. But let's get back to the filtering, because if you have like 60,000 companies and you bring it down to 149, you have to have strict filters. So what are your filters?
I always say that, to me at least, investing is all about saying no as fast as possible. So there is also, for example, a community of compounding quality, and then every day five people are asking, what do you think about stock X? What do you think about stock Y? And so on. I think we can all agree that you can't analyze everything. So what you try to do is use a strict framework, and that you indeed, usually I have found a reason to say no within 90 seconds. So trying to say no as soon as possible. For me, my investable universe and my investment approach looks a bit like a funnel, in the sense that indeed you have 60,000 listed stocks. Well, first thing you are going to do is screen for the fundamental criteria. So you want, obviously, first things first, a healthy balance sheet. You want a low capital intensity, great capital allocation, high profitability, attractive outlook, so that the company can keep growing at attractive rates, and so on. So being really strict there and using return on invested capital larger than 15%, profit margin larger than 10%, and so on and so on. Now, when you use these criteria, probably only 300 companies remain. So that's only 0.5% of all listed companies, right? Next thing, Warren Buffett said, always stay within your circle of competence. So every company that I don't understand, so where you don't understand how the company is making money, well, excluding those kind of companies, excluding businesses that are active in cyclical industries like oil and gas, mining companies, and so on. So when you do that, well, only 250 companies remain. And then you go one step further and further and further. So you add the skin in the game part layer, you screen for insider ownership, larger than 10%, founder-led businesses, and so on and so on. And that's how you basically arrive at your final investable universe. And the key goal here, or the key rationale probably, is that you try to combine different criteria that on their own should already perform quite well on the stock market. So for example, we are talking about quality investing, and moats or a sustainable competitive advantage is truly crucial. When you look, for example, at the Morningstar White Moat Index, well, you see that this index outperformed by 3.5% per year on average since 2000. To me, that's interesting. Why? Because 90% of all investors underperform the market. And by just using very straightforward, or at least straightforward to me, like a moat, you outperform by 3.5%. And when you manage to outperform by 3.5% per year for 20 years, you will probably have outperformed 98 to 99% of all investors, right? So companies with a moat outperform companies with skin in the game outperform. You have a study from Harvard Business Review that states that companies that are still led by their founder outperform by 3.9%, and so on and so on. So you're combining all those different criteria that on their own tend to do already quite well on average in the long term. And by doing that and by combining them, well, you hope in the first place that the level of outperformance even increase. And secondly, that the investable universe you created should already do quite well in the long term. So for me, and obviously you have no clue what the stock market will do today, tomorrow, this year, and so on, but I would be quite comfortable to state that when you make an equal weight ETF or portfolio out of the 149 companies within the investable universe, that you should do quite well, that it hopefully outperforms the market in the long term. And based on that investable universe, obviously you are doing your own homework, you're doing your own due diligence, and hopefully your portfolio, your stock picks are even better than the ones within your investable universe. So the stock screener and the investable universe is just to remove all the weeds and or the bad companies and try to be left over only with the wonderful companies or quality stocks. And based on that, well, then you're digging deeper and writing or analyzing the stocks and doing your homework, basically.
Very interesting filters. If there would be one that you have to compromise on, which one would it be?
It's a very tough question, right? And that's also the art of quality investing. Investing is an art. So I wouldn't say that there is one metric you can use and it's the golden goose, or also the other way around, that you can exclude one metric. I think probably two most important things are probably the moat and the return on invested capital for quality investors. At least. Well, if you should exclude a metric, it's a really tough one.
Can I give you my answer? My answer would be the insider ownership. I mean, 10% is a really high hurdle rate, especially if the company is already bigger. If a founder has like 2%, but that stake is $2 billion, worth $2 billion, I think that is still a very significant inside ownership. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think it's a very fair point. And it's also maybe two things here. First thing I took away from working in the industry, because I worked in the asset management industry for quite for 3 years, actually, is that the people working there, they are so smart. They are working 70 hours, 80 hours a week, and yet maybe 10% and probably even less than 10% outperforms the market in the long term. That's, you could ask yourself, well, why am I different? Why, if those people were spending basically their entire life on picking stocks can't do it, why should I be able to do it? And to me, it was indeed, you should try to be more like Warren Buffett and less like Wall Street, right? But also to just use a general rational approach that has proven its success in the past. And you have those criteria where you can indeed look at what worked, and founder-led businesses or high insider ownership is one of them. Obviously, when you screen for insider ownership, and definitely in the US, well, you exclude 90 to 95% of all businesses right away, or probably even more. So you are being very strict, but it allows you to know that incentives of management are aligned with the ones of you as a shareholder. And it's one thing I definitely learned from reading everything of Warren Buffett last year, 5,000 pages. Buffett talks about the importance of management over and over and over again. And I completely agree with you that, for example, take a business like MasterCard, phenomenal business. Obviously, those kind of companies don't have high inside ownership in terms of the percentage. But obviously, those businesses are huge. So even when they have a stake of 0.1%, which actually isn't the case but for MasterCard, but okay, that's in nominal amounts, in dollar amounts, it's still a lot. And in that case, you could indeed state that they have skin in the game. So I like to use the metric because you basically guarantee yourself that the incentives are aligned. But I also agree with you that when management has a stake of 2 billion or even 10 million or even 100 million, then it could be sufficient to think and act like a shareholder as well. But I guess in that case, yeah, definitely look at the track record record of the manager, what kind of person is he, and so on. So probably a bit more homework for you in that case.
Well, actually, you're making a great segue to my next question, because my question was, what is that person that you're looking for? What characteristics do you look for in great management? So what tells you this is a great CEO, for example?
Regarding insider ownership, well, preferably, I want founder-led businesses like KPG, Kelly Partners Group, Medspace, and so on, or family businesses. So usually insider ownership larger than 10%. So think about businesses like Brown & Brown, Evolution AB, and so on.
Ik vroeg eigenlijk van, wat zijn de karakteristieken van een goede manager? CEO.
Something to get to the next point of your question, I think is really funny. A lot of people are saying, as an investor, you should always let your winners run and cut your losses, right? But you can also, as Charlie Munger said, invert it in the sense that when you just look at the historical value creation of a company, the evolution of the stock price over the past 10 years, 20 years, and so on, and the stock did really well, and the company did really well, and the people who are the CEO and within management today have been doing this for 20 years. In that case, you definitely know that they are doing something good. And capital allocation is really the most important task of management, for sure. And what you see a lot of the times is that someone becomes a CEO of a business because they have the best product knowledge within the business, they are the best sales guy within the business, and so on and so on. But when they then become the CEO, they have no experience in capital allocation at all. And yet, the most important task. So that's really important. So obviously, look at the track record of those managers and how well did they do regarding capital allocation. That's really important. And when you have a CEO or when you have a founder of a stock that has been in business for 30 years, it's compounded at 20% per year over those 30 years, and the guy or the CEO still has almost all his money within the business. Well, in that case, I think that you are looking at the great manager. But always, or also remember the quote from Warren Buffett, and I'm paraphrasing probably here. Well, when you have a good manager in a bad business, it's the reputation of the bad business that remains intact, right? And also, once again, you can invert that. You have a lot of businesses that are so good, but maybe don't have skin in the game, or don't have a lot of skin in the game, like S&P Global, like Moody's, like Visa and MasterCard, and so on, that are so profitable, so good, that maybe even the skin in the game part isn't a crucial factor.
I'm going to do something, and I hope that you're not angry, Peter, but I'm going to go against Warren Buffett. Don't shut it here. I actually agree with Buffett generally, but I think that if you have a manager or a CEO who goes against the bad reputation of the industry and succeeds in turning it around, that you have something very special as well. I'm thinking about Amazon, for example. You know, e-commerce had a really bad reputation. And I'm old enough, unlike you, to remember that people said in 1995, and so nobody's going to ever give their bank account or credit card details online. And there were lots of scams. There are still scams today, of course, but not in the same way. People didn't know it. The internet was something new. And, you know, Jeff Bezos said, we are going to become a place where you can trust, where there's trust. And that, of course, is typically Buffett. Trust is actually the most valuable currency there is. I'm going back to where we were before, because there's a third element, The Art of Quality Investing, the book by Compounding Quality and Lucruze. There's that one element that I want to talk about. Compounding. How important is the compounding part?
Yeah, compounding, obviously, the essence, right? It's why we are investing in the first place. And as you probably all know, and some people say that Einstein said that it's the eighth wonder of the world. Actually, he didn't say that. But okay, I actually think that it's the eighth wonder of the world.
Well, and he should have said it.
He should have said it. Indeed. And let's give him the credits, because he did an amazing job. But okay, what's probably why not everyone is investing, why not everyone is that the magic of compounding do its work for him or her, is probably that it starts really slow. And you don't notice in the first year, and might take even 10 years before you really start to notice that the magic of compounding is working for you. And what I also think is really important is we are investors, we talk about compound interest and so on. But compounding, I think it works in so many aspects of life. Also with your knowledge, so by reading books, 10Ks, writing investment cases, and so on, you will notice that after a while, the more you read, you start to see certain connections between different aspects within life and so on. Also compounding health, so working out enough and so on. That's so important. That's also usually a lot of people are asking at the end of the podcast, right? When would you consider yourself successful? And obviously, first part is probably that you're happy and lead a happy life. But for me also, I just want to compound as much as possible. And when I state that, I'm not just referring to compound interest, to compounding money, but also just regarding your network, regarding your friends, regarding your family, regarding your knowledge and so on, to just live a meaningful life and make the most out of everything and be the best version of yourself. And how can you do that? Well, by letting the magic of compounding do its work for you, probably.
Yeah. I think that in general, the stock market is a great analogy for life. You know, we have your ups and downs, but, you know, generally you should think about going up all of your life. And that is compounding, of course. So what do you think? You know, we talked about the impressive numbers, you know, 365K followers on X, 230,000 Substack, 150,000 LinkedIn. What do you think is the biggest reason for that? If you would have to pinpoint one or a few reasons for that fast growth, what do you think those are?
I don't like this question because you obviously don't like to brag about yourself, right? And you're just having fun. And that's also funny because until I went to OMA last year, all those followers were just numbers on the screen. And then you go to OMA for the Berkshire AGM and people start approaching you. They want a picture. And so that's when the first time for me also that you start to notice, okay, these aren't just numbers on the screen, but those are people, right? And you have response about that. When you are looking about yourself and what's the reason for having a bit over 500,000 followers across social media, I think first or two important things. First, it's your passion and people can feel that and being authentic and just doing what you genuinely believe in and communicate in an open and honest way. I think that's the most important thing. And just like you, well, you were a teacher in a previous life, right? As a kid, also always wanted to become a teacher. Actually, as a matter of fact, today I would still love to do it one day or give guest lectures and so on. So I think what compounding quality is a bit, it's obviously a combination of two passions. So on the one hand, investing and financial management and stuff like that. And on the other hand, well, teaching, helping other people. So trying to probably explain concepts that might be complex for some people in a really approachable way. So trying to write like you would to your 7-year-old niece or something like that. Well, I think that's something really important and that probably helped over time.
Great. I was a teacher as well, and I recognize that part in you definitely. So let's get back to the book. Again, I really enjoyed the book. I would even say, and you can totally disagree with me here, that this is actually a form of manual for quality investing. Do you agree?
Yeah, completely agree. And I'm happy that you are saying that because that was the entire purpose of the book. Because we felt like, obviously, we all know Benjamin Graham and a lot has been written and a lot of books have been written about value investing. You can read interesting stuff about growth investing from Phil Fisher or potential multibaggers, right? But you felt like or not that many books and not that much stuff has been written about quality investing. So what the book basically tries to do, and once again, credits to those who deserve, all credits to Le Cruze. The book tries to give a framework from A to Z of quality investing. So what is quality investing? Well, does it work? How can you find these kind of companies? Obviously, wonderful companies, so often trading at very rich valuation levels. How should you think about valuation? How can you determine whether a company is fairly valued or not? And then last part of the book is how can you build and maintain a portfolio. There were also some people over the last week who asked, well, what's the difference between the book, for example, and the website you have, Compounding Quality? And how I would summarize it is that the book is indeed a framework for quality investing. So you learn how to invest in quality stocks, basically. And then the website, Compounding Quality, is more the putting the theory into practice, actually looking at those kind of companies, writing investment cases, looking at the portfolio, and so on. So happy that I had the opportunity to work on this one with Luc. And hopefully we can improve some investors' lives and improve their knowledge. And then I think the book has been a success for us. So once again, the teaching part and trying to help other people, then it has been a success.
I'm going into something that you just said, because I think you do discredit to the book partly. You say, the website is putting the theory into practice. But one of the things that I really love about the book is that it's not just theory. It's actually a very practical book. That's why I called it the manual. Mm. Yes, there is the theory that shows the background and the basics, but it's much more. It's really a practical guide for every investor. You know, if you read this book after you finished and you say, I don't know how to invest in quality, well, then you haven't read the book. It's really very practical, with very practical filters, for example.
I'm quite happy that you stated that, and probably indeed plenty of examples are given in the book. And when you just write down all the examples that we are talking about in the book, well, you have quite a great list already and quite a quality investable universe. So that's also obviously, when you talk about theory, you will already remember a fraction of it. But when you combine the theory with a practical example, and we think, for example, just saying something, LVMH is a quality stock for reason X, Y, and Z, well, that's what you will remember and how you will remember the book, and it will make everything more concrete, and it will help you to, when you are looking at the company yourself, to recognize those characteristics and to make your homework yourself.
I will show you once more, because of is on the front page. So there is a castle with a moat. Can you talk about, you already said, so the moat is, for people who don't know Warren Buffett that well, the moat is one of the most crucial criteria for Warren Buffett. He's also the one that called it a moat. So everybody talking about a moat now, that's because of Warren Buffett. So how do you think about durable competitive advantages? So because that's what a moat means.
I'm happy that you touched upon that, because indeed for us, it was really important that on the front cover, there was a castle with a moat around it, because it's really the essence of quality investing. It's the first step. And when a company doesn't have a moat or competitive advantage, well, you won't bother looking at it anyway. So that's the first step. So that's also what we state. Well, you don't invest in the next big thing. You invest in companies that have already won. Now, how can you recognize a company with a moat? Probably two things. First thing is pricing power. So that the company has the ability to increase prices, and basically customers just stay or remain loyal to the company. How can you measure pricing power? Probably a high and sustainable gross margin and so on. Something really attractive. Why? Because it's also a protection against inflation. Inflation obviously was a hot topic over the past few years. And then second part, the return on invested capital. So when a company has a high and sustainable gross margin as well as return on invested capital, then it's already a serious indication that the company has a moat. And a moat is really crucial. And remember, we already touched upon it. When you look at the Morningstar White Moat Index, for example, well, this index outperformed by 3.5% per year on average over the past 20 years. Maybe one side note to make here, but I think it's also really important, is that you or investors and listeners should understand that a moat is never static, and that a moat is evolving every time. Moat is shrinking or widening every day. So really important, and management should work on widening the moat every single day, because when you have a quality stock and it's losing its moat, take Kodak, for example. Well, in that case, it's a quality stock. So it's trading at rich valuation levels and expectations are also high. And when in that case, well, a disruptor is able to enter the market and take market share, the growth of the intrinsic value of the company will go down and the multiple goes down. So in that case, you have a double-edged sword, a negative sense. And that's probably the largest risk for quality investors. So keeping an eye on the moat is really important for quality.
Yeah. And I really love what you say about a moat that is never static. That's also what I say. You know, we focus on different things with Tension Multibaggers and Multibagger Nuggets. I focus on earlier stage companies. Mm-hmm. And, people often ask me, what's the moat? And I said, there is no moat, because a moat has to be dug, right? It takes time to dig a moat. And I think a moat is only for more mature companies. And it's, you know, we have some competitive advantages, but a moat is really a strong competitive advantage that is more durable than just competitive advantage. So I really totally agree with what you say about moats being static, and, you know, they have to be protected and, you know, make sure that the water doesn't get too shallow so people can just cross. Competitors can just cross.
What I'm going to add, because otherwise I'm going to forget, what I really appreciate about our friendship is that Indeed, our investment approaches are at least somewhat different, and some will stay completely different. So you are more focused on the winners of tomorrow, right? And for compounding quality, it's more the established companies. So probably a bit more slower growth, but hopefully to do slightly above average for very long periods of time. But it's really important that to understand that there are multiple roads that lead to Rome, and there are multiple investment approaches that work. And what you see a lot of the times on X or Twitter or just among friends and so on, is that when someone is focusing on growth and someone else, for example, on value, that they are clashing and don't agree and you are a fool and things like that. But we have a different investment approach, and yet we talk about the market and so on so often, and we completely understand and have respect for each other. And I think that's a really important thing. And also in the investment field, just look at opposing or listen at opposing views on the market, on certain companies and so on, can be so powerful, because we should keep learning all the time, keep evolving all the time. And probably also in 10 years from now, 20 years from now, our investment approach will have evolved, and you will look at yourself off today like a fool, what kind of stupid mistakes I made back then. So yeah, that's something I really appreciate about our friendship.
I think we both did something that every investor should do, and that is find their own particular style of investing that fits their personality the best. You know, absolutely. Just like my bookcase here represents who I am, with a lot of investing books, but also lots of novels and even poetry and books about sports, etc. Mm-hmm. So in the same way, your portfolio should reflect who you are. And I think that is very necessary. If you borrow conviction from someone else, it's impossible to keep the companies in your portfolio for a longer term if you don't really believe in it, if you just bought the ticker by, you know, just to say, not the company. And I think in that way, we also have a lot in common, that we look at the companies and we invest for the long term. And even that is rare nowadays, with so many people just focusing on the next few weeks or months and not, you know, decades out. I think that, by the way, I wanted to ask something in that respect. If you talk about the future, now, suppose you have bought, for example, Copart, or in my case, Constellation Software, which I think are both quite expensive at this moment. How do you think about that? You have bought the stock and it's really expensive. What do you do?
A very good question, tough question. And to be honest, it's something that keeps me away at night, in the sense that, for example, indeed, we already touched upon that. I wouldn't buy Copart today. I wouldn't buy Constellation today due to valuation concerns, right? But on the other end of the story, my answer would be when I would have bought both companies during the COVID crisis. And as a matter of fact, I really looked into Constellation. I didn't buy it during the COVID crisis, so shame on me. But when I would, let's suppose that I would have bought both companies, I probably would still own them today. I would have no intention to sell them at all. So just selling because purely based on valuation concerns is a really difficult thing. And obviously we are here to talk about the art of quality investing, but this week I also finished what I learned about investing from Darwin. Also an excellent book, and he basically says the same. So I wouldn't sell because of valuation concerns. And to add even to that, when a company, well, does really well and goes to 10, 11, or even 12% of your portfolio, I wouldn't probably trim the position and just let your winners run. So the most important thing here probably is, well, what's the reason to sell? Probably main reason, almost the only reason, is that your investment thesis was wrong. So that you thought that the company had a moat, but actually they didn't, or the moat was less strong than you thought it was. So yeah, letting your winners run, very important to me and very essential. The longer your investment horizon, the less important valuation becomes and the more important the growth of the intrinsic value becomes. But obviously, when you overpay for even the best company in the world, you can end up with horrible investment results for a few years. Look what happened with Walmart in around 2004. Look at what happened with Coca-Cola when they were trading at 50 times PE. So yeah, wonderful companies at a fair price to start with. But once you find them, once you've bought them, probably just letting them run as long as everything goes well.
Yeah, I agree. I do the same thing. If you have to talk about books, let's talk about books. I mean, of course, everybody has to read The Art of Quality Investing. I will say, because I know you're too humble to say that yourself. You know, if you want to talk about books, if people ask you, oh, can you talk about, you know, which books should I read? What are the first books that pop to your mind?
Investment books or not investment books?
Well, you can talk about both if you want, but I was actually thinking about investment books.
Okay. Yeah. Like just said, I think what I learned about investing from Darwin was really refreshing, because probably the same for you. Over time, you've read hundreds of investment books, and after a while, it's more or less more of the same, right? But that's one I really enjoyed. Also enjoyed The Joys of Compounding from Gautam, obviously. Gautam
Bates. Fantastic. Fantastic.
A great friend. And also, obviously, Richer, Wiser, Happier from William Green. But then if I just should pick one thing, and it's free, and it's, I'm a big Warren Buffett fan and a freak in a positive sense of the word, but I'll just say last year I spent a few months reading everything Buffett has said and written. It's freely available on the internet, 5,000 pages, but it's everything you will probably ever need. And it's more than you will learn in whatever course you take, whatever university study you do, and so on. So that's something I absolutely loved. But maybe what I would also like to add is, over time, also reading non-investing books can be really great information for you as an investor as well. So for example, this week, I'm also rereading The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And what I thought was funny is I read the book the first time 11 years ago, I think when I was 16 years old. And now I'm rereading it, but you are rereading it and you are taking away completely different things. Probably I'm biased. Right now I'm thinking that I'm taking away more than I did 11 years ago. But just how your vision evolved and so on, something really important. And based on that, for example, rule number 2 of the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People is start with the end in mind. For example, for your life, when you're 8 years old, what would for you be the definition of a happy life? Would you prefer to indeed be the most successful investor, or would you want to be the most successful dad for your children, right? But also, you can take that to the stock market. If you look at the end of your career regarding investing and so on, what kind of companies do you want to own when you're still 30 years? Would you want to own the potential turnaround active in something unethical like cigarettes and so on? Or do you want to own a great business that is hopefully also beneficial for society? So that also helped me actually probably add a new position to the portfolio and trimming down another position within the portfolio. But as of now, I'll keep that for myself, if that's okay for you.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I'll read it when it's out. I really like David Gardner of The Motley Fool. I think he's one of the best growth investors ever. He'll hate me that I say that, because he hates the division between growth investors and value investors. And he even invites to that arm him every time he would say it. So one of the things that I learned from him is the importance of management. We already talked about it. And he says it's underrated how important a CEO can be. For example, like Amazon, he says like one of the moats we have at Amazon is we have Jeff Bezos and you don't. How do you think about that?
Yeah, I think he's completely right. And that's also why I put so much emphasis on management. And that's probably the good thing, because the essence of quality investing is you invest in companies that have already won. So those companies often have a very strong track record. And when the same manager is leading the business for many years and is still doing today, well, in that case, you know that he did something well, that he was really successful within the business. And you indeed have exceptional people like Jeff Bezos. I think Brad Kelly from KPG is also one, obviously Mark Zuckerberg and so on. So those are the companies or at least I am looking for. And that's something I really miss. Maybe it's the only thing I miss from leaving the industry, is that I had access to a Bloomberg. And with Bloomberg, you could screen for companies. For example, you could just enable only show me founder-led businesses. And then next step, only show me founder-led businesses that grew their revenue by 10% per year and had a profit margin of 10% and so on and so on. So I think that was a beautiful thing, because when you try to look for those kind of companies, I am at least not really aware of the somewhat affordable tool that allows you to screen for those kind of companies. So you really need to go dig yourself and do your homework. But I think that when you find those kind of businesses, great things can happen to you, especially when they're still somewhat smaller and they have plenty of room for growth.
I think we should talk to Braden from finchat.io. He's so good. And I think for 1% of a Bloomberg terminal, you get like probably 75% of the value of Bloomberg. It's a great platform. I think you use it as well. And
Yeah, exactly.
I think I would advise everyone to try it out. I'm coming back to the filter of management in this case. I'm thinking about now a company that I really like and that I have in my portfolio as well, full disclosure here, Nintendo.
Mm-hmm.
That's one that would never pop on your screen because, you know, Nintendo is like, I don't remember exactly, like 120 years old or something.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the founder doesn't have any stake in the company anymore. So do you sometimes think about I'm missing companies because of that or just part of a game?
Yeah, sure. So obviously, and it's a beautiful thing. Multiple roads that lead to Rome, right? And we don't have to, when everyone would have the same portfolio, it would be a boring world. But for me, I created three buckets where you want to invest in. First bucket, and indeed, that's the largest one, is the owner-operator stocks. So quality with skin in the game, basically. Second bucket is the monopolies and oligopolies. So companies active in sectors where only a few dominate the entire industry, have pricing power and so on, like elevator companies, Otis and Kone, hearing aids companies like Sonova, Visa, MasterCard, and so on. Often beautiful businesses. The interesting part there is when you look at the portfolio of Warren Buffett and also all the historical positions he has had in the past, almost all of them are active in an oligopoly or a monopoly. So probably if Buffett likes it, well, it can make sense for us to look at it too. And then the third bucket are the cannibal stocks. And I think it was Monish Pabrai who popularized the term. So stocks that are heavily buying back their own shares. And when this is the case, and obviously share buybacks only create value when a stock is undervalued. But when the company trades at cheap valuation levels and they are heavily buying back shares, well, in that case, beautiful things can happen. Think about companies like NVR and AutoZone, for example, who bought back 90% of their outstanding shares since 1990. Well, when you look at those, the evolution of their intrinsic value, the evolution of their stock prices, well, those were businesses you would have wanted to own. So for me, indeed, skin in the game is important. Owner-operator stocks are the majority of the portfolio. But besides that, there are also, yeah, the oligopoly and monopoly bucket, as well as the cannibal stocks. So I feel comfortable to know that management is invested in the business with its own money. And I can agree with you as well that isn't a necessity. That obviously it can still be a very good investment when management doesn't have skin in the game. But yeah, I just feel comfortable to know that the incentives are aligned. And it was Charlie Munger who said, well, I always thought that incentives were very important during my entire life. And I've always underestimated that. So I feel a bit the same way. So that's why it's so important to me probably.
Yeah. Well, I come back to what you said about different roads leading to Rome. I heard in Invest Like the Best podcast of Patrick O'Shaughnessy that there have been identified 300 ways that outperform the market if applied rigorously or consequentially. And I think that last word is very important because a lot of people jump from strategy to strategy because there will always be times when you underperform whatever strategy you choose. And if you jump from one hot strategy to the next, you will always lose because you always get in at the top and or near the top. And then, you know, the stocks in that basket drop. And I think that's why it's good to have a theoretical framework that you can use to invest in. How do you think about quality investing, how it is in the market right now? I mean, is it becoming too popular?
Fair question, I guess. And then a fair answer is that over the past 20 years, 30 years, even longer, obviously we have had declining interest rates. And that's something that has been good for quality investing as well as growth investing, probably because those companies are trading at richer valuation multiples, right? But you notice that quality investing indeed is becoming more and more popular. But I don't see any problem in that because just take the owner's earnings of Francois Rochon, for example, his concept. In the long term, while stock prices will always follow the evolution of the intrinsic value. And quality companies, well, the essence of the philosophy there is that you invest in companies that can grow their intrinsic value per share at very attractive rates. And when this is still the case, well, you will be definitely be fine as a quality investor. And I also completely agree with you that as an active investor, by definition, you will underperform from time to time. So probably value investor in the traditional sense of the word had a tough time over the past 10 years and even longer. But one day the tables will turn and value investing will thrive and the other way around. That's something that's really important. Same goes for EM, for emerging markets right now. And I always take my mother because she's the classical example. example of the know-nothing investor. Sorry, mom. But she also just buys an index fund on the MSCI World, as well as one on the Emerging Markets Index. And she always says, okay, why should I buy emerging markets? I've been doing this since 3 years now. And the only thing is it does nothing or it even declines. So just let's stop that. But I always say to her, no, that's not true. There will come a day that the tables will turn. And in that case, you will be very happy to have one. And last thing to add here, maybe indeed, is that every investor is unique. And it's really important that you determine for yourself what kind of investor you are and that you choose a strategy that suits you as an investor. Because, yeah, you can borrow someone's ID, but you can never borrow someone's conviction. And when things get tough, when, for example, quality would do less well over the next few months or even years, well, when you don't feel comfortable with the strategy in that case, you will never be able to pursue when things get tough. And that's really important, probably one of the most important things. And I think we already discussed during our last dinner that you recommended me a great book of Napoleon Hill. And
oh yeah, Outwitting the Devil.
Exactly. So last dinner, we talked about Napoleon Hill. And what he basically once said is, well, an excellent person is someone who can do the average when everyone around him is losing his mind. And the same goes when investing, when things are really tough. Well, stay rational and stay the course in that case. And that's really crucial to be a good investor, probably.
Yeah, I have my framework of dollar cost averaging on steroids. So I always invest the same amount every 2 weeks. But when the market drops, I have certain, you know, limits. If it drops this much, I invest this much more. Yeah. So it can go 2x if the market is down like 30% or something. In general, I invest a lot more. So that's my approach. I'm looking at the time here and we have been talking for quite a while now. So just a few questions to round off. One is about Warren Buffett and about quality investing, because I think, and that may be controversial for some people, I think that Warren Buffett has been a closet quality investor since 1972 when Charlie Munger convinced him to buy See's candies. How do you think about this?
Yeah, and I completely agree with you. So 72 was the year that Berkshire bought See's candies, and that's when Buffett, thanks to Charlie Munger, began to see the power of pricing, power of great companies, right? If I recall it correctly, in his 1979 shareholder letter, he also said, well, I want to invest in companies when two criteria are met. One, when the return on equity over the past 10 years has averaged at least 20%. And two, when the return on equity has never fallen below 10%. And he stated that when you look for these criteria, I remember 79, that's when you needed to go through the manuals and do the calculations all yourself, right? That less than 10% of all companies remained. And those were often really good businesses. And even in 79, they performed really well. So even then, Warren Buffett was already focusing on quality criteria, on pricing power, on the moat and so on. So I agree with you that Buffett has been a quality investor for almost 50 years now. So that's phenomenal. He has obviously been really successful. So it's a strategy that works.
It's a good thing that this comes out after we went to Omaha to the annual general meeting of Berkshire Hathaway. So people don't attack us for saying this and, you know, value investors, especially because Warren Buffett has for a long time actually still talked or identified himself as a value investor when I think he was already a full quality investor.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And maybe to add, well, Pat Bryce said, I'm a shameless copycat. Same goes for me. No need to try and reinvent new things. Just look at what worked. Very successful investors in the past, like Warren Buffett. And by reading his shareholder letters, by reading his books, by going to the AGM, well, you learn a lot. And yeah, it's better to start and quote unquote copy from something that worked already than starting on your own right away. So Munger also said that, well, their answers were billions of dollars in a $20 history book. So reading and learning from other people, from really successful people like yourself, Chris, that's a true blessing. So I'm really happy for that.
I'm completely flabbergasted now by that compliment. So I think it's time to round off. Peter, thank you very much for your time and your great knowledge and sharing that generously with us. Again, I would advise everyone to read The Art of Quality Investing, the great book by Lucruzzo and Compounding Quality, Peter. So thank you very much. And we'll see each other soon, right?
Thank you very much. It was a true honor. And let's chat soon.
I hope you enjoyed this content. None of this is financial advice, so don't buy stocks only based on this information. Chris and the guests may have positions in the stocks they discuss. Get much more free and paid content at multibaggernuggets.com.